All right, I'm going to get started. I think there's one more person coming, but that's all right. My name's Karen Smith. I'm a professor of international relations. I'm also the departmental tutor, which means I'm in charge of undergraduate students studying for the BSCIR. What I'm going to do is just talk briefly about the courses that you have to take as part of your degree. Then I'll say a little bit about studying in the International Relations Department. And then I will talk a little bit about the first year course that you have to take, IR 100, and one of the topics that falls under that course, which is human rights and international relations. And I'll just give you a flavor of the kinds of questions that you're going to have to ask yourself and answer by the end of your first year. You are going to need to have some sort of a perspective on the various questions that I'll say. So first of all, what are you going to study? Now, you should know this because presumably you are the internet generation and you already memorized all of the appropriate web pages. But just to repeat this information, in your first year, you have to take two courses. The first is an IR course, IR 100, Structure of International Society, which is going to introduce you to key concepts and theories. I will discuss a little bit about that in a minute. And then the second is you have to take history, because history, you have to know your history. I mean, IR is not just theory, it is empirical things, and therefore you've got to know your history. So we require you to take an international history course. Furthermore, because international relations is a discipline which draws on many other disciplines, it is, in essence, multidisciplinary itself. It draws on law, it draws on sociology, it draws on government and political science, and so on. We then require you to take a course from a cognate department, right, which is will help you understand international relations. And so you can either take a government course, Introduction to Political Theory, a philosophy course, Introduction to Philosophy, or a sociology course, Introduction to Sociological Theory, all three being cognate disciplines on which international relations has drawn. And then you are free to take an approved paper outside of the department for your fourth course. Some take languages, for example, as part of their course. You could also take an economic history course, many other government courses, history courses, and law courses in your first year. Then all first-year students at the LSC have to take, in the Lent term, LSC 100. I'm sure you've heard about LSC 100, and I'm not going to go over that, but that's one other thing that you have to do in your first year. All right. Second year, then, you have three required courses. First is international political theory, second is foreign policy analysis, and third is international organizations, of which there are hundreds in international affairs. So those are your three required courses in the second year. You then have a relatively free choice for your fourth course in that particular year, which will come from courses on economics, history, and public international law, or languages. In addition, all second year students at the LSE have to take in the Michaelmas term LSE 100, and they have to be examined on that on the day before they come back for the Lent term. Right? And there, if you don't do that, you'll be required to do it again. So LSE 100 is required, but it doesn't count. The mark doesn't count towards your final classification of your degree. All right, third year. You have a choice. You've got three papers, three courses that you have to three full units that you have to make up in the third year, coming from this particular list. So things such as nationalism, strategic aspects of international relations, Europe, UN, and so on. So you've got a choice of three from that list. You could also choose to write a 10,000-word dissertation, independent study, and it is unsupervised, an unsupervised dissertation. And then for your final paper, you can choose from a selection of courses outside the department, which again, if you're taking languages, you could continue language. If you're taking law, you could continue your interest in law. If you're taking economics, you could continue an interest in economics with that 12th paper. All right, so that's the structure of the degree. Now, what does it mean? What happens every day? Well, presumably, you are in the library studying away. I hope so. I hope the library is now stuffed with students studying for their exams in May. But other than that, you have to attend most classes. Sometimes the law department's a bit odd. Some teachers do different things in the third year. But usually it means you attend a lecture every week, which is 15 minutes of somebody standing up and talking to you, and you take notes. And then also a small class, which is up to 14, no more than 14 students, which looks in depth at one of the topics every single week. Attendance at classes is compulsory, and you could get into major trouble if you don't attend classes. And then on top of that, you are expected to do extensive, and by extensive, I mean treat this as a full-time job, 40 hours a week, right? That means 40 hours a week in your studies. Extensive unsupervised reading, studying, and class preparation. Because to each class, you need to go in there ready to talk, right? No class teacher likes somebody who sits and says nothing, right? You are the leeches. We don't like people who don't talk in classes. You'll have to give presentations, and you will have to write essays, all right? Now, most courses in the LSE, and especially in the International Relations Department, are formally assessed by one method of assessment, which is the final exam. That's 100% of your mark. However, throughout the year, you have to write essays which help you to prepare for that exam, and those are also compulsory, and if you don't write them, you could get into big trouble. So the essays are sort of helping you to prepare for the exam and improving your writing skills and your understanding of the course material and so on. So good skills, right? And they tend to be short, about 1,500 words. So you learn to write pithily and to the point, very focused kind of essays. Then you also will have to do inevitably oral presentations, right? And again, then this doesn't count towards your final mark, but if you don't do them, you could get into big trouble. But there are an opportunity for you to then develop different skills, the skill of speaking in public, of preparing a focused, short, 10 to 15 minute argument, right, that is focused on the particular topic of whatever that class is dealing with. So you will have an idea of how you are doing, right up until the exam, okay? So you've got plenty of opportunity for feedback to test out your ideas and so on. Okay, so that's what you do every week, week in, week out, until you have this massive, which is why I presume that the library is full of people studying for their final exams, right? Then you have an academic advisor. Right, so somebody from the department who has the job of following you and making sure that you are doing things like writing your essays and showing up to class. You can discuss things like careers, what you want to do with careers. Not that we are career advisors, but we might have an idea of advice we can give you. What you might want to do over the summer and your course selection. Right, so those courses that you have some choice over, you could discuss that over with your academic advisor. You will also have to see them every term to discuss what you've done in the previous term. Right? So that's somebody, that's a resource. Right? You can go and talk to them, usually during their office hours. Right? Now on our website, on the IR department's website, there is a frequently asked questions, which means they are frequently asked, and there are answers, which means that if you ask me now, I will say go to the website because we have a set little answer there. Should have all the information you need, but you never know. So that's one place to look. You also receive this. I don't think this is ever read by students, but it should be. It has everything I say today, plus lots more in this book, including advice on exam preparation, writing essays, taking notes in lectures, and how to prepare for an oral presentation. Right? So lots of information in this. You'll get this at the beginning of the academic year in October. All right. So that's practically every student at the LSE has to do that. What then do you also do in the IR department? Well, there is a student club called the Grimshaw Club, which a lot of students, BSc, so BSc, MSc, and PhD students are involved in the Grimshaw Club. And they do things like invite outside speakers to speak, that for anybody, really, that has any, you could come up with your own ideas of people to invite to speak. They also have coffee mornings with members of staff, so we might be convinced to come along, have a coffee, chat about our research. I think they host a dinner every year and a class trip, a trip somewhere that could be somewhere exciting, like Russia, or I believe some places. There's some, where are they going this year? That I was shocked. It's like, are you getting all of your inoculations and vaccinations? Are you wearing a flak jacket? It was somewhere. I wish I could remember. Anyway, you'll be able to find out about that next year. But anyway, so they organize trips, right? You have to pay for the trips, but they organize trips. Right, so that's an IR student club, a specific IR student club, in addition to the dozens of other student clubs there are at the LSC. Then, as a student in the International Relations Department, you have access to meetings at Chatham House. Chatham House is also known as the Royal Institute of International Affairs. It's a major think tank. Check out the website. They hold regular lunchtime meetings to which our students can sign up and go along and attend. Right? Then there is something called Cumberland Lodge, which is in Windsor, right underneath the flight path to Heathrow. But when the Queen stays there, the planes don't go over Cumberland Lodge because, of course, the Queen wouldn't want to be disturbed by the planes. But beautiful area, huge park. And then there is a lodge there which is used by departments at the LSC and other universities. And one weekend in November, the IR department holds a sort of little student conference in which members of staff or outside speakers will come and speak on a particular theme every year. All right, and you have to, I think you have to pay a little bit of money for it, but you could also apply for funding as well. All right, so that's every November, Cumberland Lodge weekend. Then there is a journal which is not formally any longer connected to the International Relations Department since it's an independent charity, but it's called Millennium Journal of International Relations. It used to be run out of the IR department, but it is run, managed entirely by international relations students. So students are the sort of the editorial board, and you can go along to editorial board meetings. I'm not sure exactly how often they are held, but they are held regularly, and essentially form part of the running of this particular academic journal. So that's Millennium Editorial Board. In addition, if you are not taking language as one of those extra courses, you know, that fourth course in every year, that fourth free choice you have in every year, you could, if you decide you have lots of free time on your hands, you could, which you might, if you're particularly well organized, you can take a language center course as a sort of non-degree student. So you could sign up and take Russian, elementary Russian, or Italian, or French, or Spanish, or they have a list of classes. And those cost money if you're not doing it as part of your degree. But the International Relations Department will give you money. You can have a grant that will pay for most of the cost of that course. Okay, so you could, in addition, do a language center course, which is partially or mostly paid for by the International Relations Department. Okay, so that gives you a flavor of what you have to do, the kind of courses you have to take, the kind of requirements you're going to be expected to fulfill, and the kind of opportunities you have from the International Relations Department. I now just want to say a bit more about the first year course, which is IR 100, Structure of International Society. What are the kind of topics that are covered in this course? Well, something called the balance of power. Right, have you heard of the balance of power? Hands up if you heard of the balance of power. Okay, is that democratic peace theory? Anybody heard of the democratic peace theory? Okay. Concepts such as sovereignty, been introduced to concepts such as sovereignty. Globalization, I mean, surely. Globalization, I mean, that's it's like the buzzword of the 21st century. All right. You will those of you who've never heard of it, and those of you who have will look at it from a different perspective, I'm sure, cover things like the balance of power, which is a very realist approach to international relations. And you'll critique it or love it, but you'll have to justify your critique or your love of the balance of power. You'll also learn about democratic peace theory, and this is a sort of hypothesis which some say is the only proven hypothesis in international relations, that is, democracies don't go to war with each other. Again, you'll critique that, you'll analyze it, critique it, or love it, but you'll have to come up with your reasons why you don't like it or like it. So those are the sort of, you know, what constitutes, how do you get peace in international relations? And then you'll discuss war. What is war? It's not a straightforward definition at all. Do you have to be wearing a uniform if you're to have a state of war? Or do guerrillas who are wearing jeans and flip-flops count? Right? Is war only between states, or is war within states? In other words, there's quite a lot to dig into when you start talking about war. Same with peace. What is peace? Right? Is peace simply the absence of war? Right? Is Kosovo at peace simply because people aren't dying? Right? Others, there are some theorists who would say there's no such, peace has to be much more positive. You have to have positive peace. So it's not just the absence of violence. Right? It's actual things like a just and fair society. So again, you'll sort of critique that kind of a concept. Sovereignty, huge. What does sovereignty mean? Right? We have this classic, it's almost a knee-jerk, if you're the president or prime minister of a country, you have almost knee-jerk response, or national sovereignty. What does that mean? And is there such a thing as a fully sovereign country in the 21st century, or the 19th century, or the 5th century, for that matter? What does sovereignty mean? Traditionally, I mean, the sort of the classic definition is there's no higher authority above a state. So states can do whatever the heck they want. Can they? Right? I mean, is this really reflective of empirical reality? So again, sovereignty, concept you'll dig into, right, to analyze it, critique it, perhaps love it. Globalization, right? Schmobilization, I like to say. What does globalization mean? Some people say it means everything's going faster. Well, if you were in the Victorian age, you would have thought everything was going faster too. So what's the difference? I mean, what does globalization mean? Again, another one of those concepts that you'll dig into. Some people think with a globalized world, we're all going to live happily ever after. Others think globalized world means homogenized world, which means sort of death. I mean, can't think of anything worse than a homogenized, globalized world, which deprives local cultures of meaning. Right. Global governance, another one of these buzzwords, classic buzzwords. People who think, oh, we might not have a sort of a single government, but we do have something called global governance, which means everybody gets together, cheerfully works together to solve the world's problems. Do we? What are the blocks on global governance? And what are the building blocks on it? And so on. So again, another one of those key concepts you're going to dig into, critique, analyze, love, whatever. Okay? All right. Then you'll cover sort of things such as the role of the United States. I mean, there are still people who go around saying it is the sole power, single hegemonic power today. Then there are those analysts who say, no, it's on its way down, never to rise again. Right? You'll debate that. Right? Do you need a single liberal hegemon to guarantee peace in international relations? Alongside of that, the rise of Asia, role of China in particular, will be discussed. A classic, I've read I don't know how many essays last year on this. Can China's rise be peaceful? Right? If you believe in the balance of power theory, you would disagree. Right? Because a rising power automatically is challenging other powers, and that is an unstable situation. Right? Then north-south equality, north and south, even though those kinds of geographical categories turn out to be less meaningful than one might think. But inequality, right? And things such as justice and distributive justice, poverty, global poverty, perhaps the duties the rich have towards the poor. Do they have duties towards the poor that live in other countries and don't pay taxes in their own countries, right? So global inequality. And then there are other issues, environment, climate change, right? Can global governance help solve climate change? And if not, why not? Gender, the role of women, the role of males, of females in things like war and peace, right? Religion and culture, their role in various and sundry international processes, including war and peace. Role of human rights, development of a global human rights culture, they would say, some would say, especially NGOs working in human rights. Does that have an impact on sovereignty, on war, on peace? Right? And intervention. Should we intervene in Syria to save Syrians from their own government? Right? Do we go against the national sovereignty of Syria to save Syrians? Right? So what are the rights and wrongs of intervention? Okay. What I'm going to go dig down a little bit more into then is the human rights, which happens to be something that I have written about to some extent with respect to the European Union, but human rights and I are in general. All right, what is the dilemma here? What are the issues that are raised for international relations by human rights? All right. Okay, we have a situation, I think even sort of rosy-spectacled liberals would acknowledge that states, United Kingdom, United States, China, and so on, are the dominant players in the international system. Right? How dominant is open to interpretation, but they are the dominant players in the international system. They love, each and every one of them, from Sweden to China, love the concept of national sovereignty. Nobody can tell us what to do. Nobody can intervene with us. Nobody can interfere in our domestic. We have complete control over what happens within our domestic jurisdiction. And this principle of sovereignty has been one of the key organizing principles of international relations. Right? Okay. Along comes human rights, which says, well, borders shouldn't matter, so that people, no matter whether they live in Gabon or in the United Kingdom, have the same sort of rights, the right not to be tortured, the right to live, the right perhaps even to vote in a free election, the right to a free press, and so on. Right. And the idea in the human rights movement is that these are universal. So they apply whether you're in Gabon or whether you are in the United Kingdom. So they are applicable to all people regardless of those domestic jurisdictions. Okay? All right. Now, at the international level, there is an extensive machinery that expresses this idea. Above all, it was obvious in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was declared in 1948 and signed up to by every single member of the UN at the time. Right, in 1948. There are a whole host of international treaties. The International Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, to which almost every single state in the world has signed up. Right? And that's just the two biggest ones, loads of other ones. All right? And those treaties have mechanisms which are supposed to ensure that states at least have to account for themselves if they don't abide by the key principles of those treaties. There's something called the Human Rights Council at the United Nations level, which does things like point out when countries aren't abiding by those particular commitments. There's something called the International Criminal Court, right, which could try individuals which are guilty of particularly grievous crimes, such as crimes against humanity, genocide, or war crimes. Right? In other words, there's built up an international machinery which expresses this idea that all human rights, all people have the right, certain kinds of rights, right, no matter where they live. That clashes with sovereignty, because how can you implement or compel states to obey, comply with those particular commitments that they have signed up to, right? How can you compel Syria, right, to respect human rights, not kill civilians? How can you? Do you have a right to do others have a right to do so? So that tension between these sort of universalizing principles and state sovereignty, right, is the first one of those topics that you will cover in Structure of International Society. Right. So the questions, I put this all up in questions, and it is questions, right? You will have to think about those questions and what your answers to those questions are, but I'm not gonna, there is no correct answer. There is just a series of arguments and debates that one can have. So questions, for example, are human rights more important than state sovereignty, right? So that the individual trumps state sovereignty, all right? Okay, one might, the NGOs, human rights NGOs, obviously take those kinds of positions, or at least many of them do. But then which human rights are the most important? I mean, just saying human rights is like saying globalization. What does it mean? Are they just political rights, the right to vote, right? Do they apply to everyone, right? Male, female, all cultures, all races? Social rights, the right to be in a trade union, right? To bargain collectively. Is that something that every single individual on this earth has a right to? Right? The right to development, that actually the rich in the north should, must pay, right, poor countries so that they can develop, right? Because they have the right to develop, okay? Rights go with duties, right? Some, there's a connection there, right? Which of those are more important? Which trumps, okay? Right. Related then to this question of states, which is more important, human rights or state sovereignty, then is the question of can or should state sovereignty be ignored by external actors, which could include states, could include international organizations, NATO, the UN, the Arab League, which has talked about intervening in Syria, or NGOs, right? The media, external actors, okay? Should state sovereignty be ignored by external actors to protect the rights of citizens in another state, all right? Then, if they do, if they can, or they should do that, what does that mean? Should they name and shame countries for violating human rights? Some say that's the only thing we can do in international relations, is name and shame, right? But lots of countries out there object to this. There was, outside of the Human Rights Council about 3 or 4 years ago, an actual physical fight. I mean, you know, people punching each other. Between the Cuban, pro-Cuban activists and Cuban human rights activists, because Cuba objected to being named and shamed in the Human Rights Council, right? So naming and shaming could be pretty meaningless. You violate human rights. Yeah, so what? We can shake that off. But it also clearly gets several people worked up enough to have fights, physical fights in an international organization in Geneva, which some might say is meaningless in and of itself. Right. So that's sort of, should they name and shame? NGOs make their living by doing that, naming and shaming. Then, should they impose trade sanctions on countries that violate human rights? Right. Syria right now has trade sanctions on it, for example. That, of course, damages the right to development. It hurts people, particularly companies that are dealing with that country, right? Can they, right? Should they impose trade sanctions? It's not going to war, right? It's better than war, but it's also a little bit more than naming and shaming. And then should countries give aid only to countries that are well-governed, protect human rights, and perhaps are democratic, So you have you exercise political conditionality, right? So that taxpayers' money isn't fueling sort of little holes of despotism in some backwater in, say, Africa, right? Should you put conditions on that aid, right? That might go against the right to development, and certainly several countries have taken that perspective. The conditionality violates the right to development. But that's also short of war. Then we have those options that involve violence, that is, intervening militarily to protect civilians. NATO did it in Libya to save initially the people of Benghazi, right? The question now is, should they do so in Syria? And the Arab League, unbelievably, has been seriously debating this particular option, whether or not it's necessary, having spent most of its existence arguing the opposite, right? It has now changed, seems to have changed its view. All right. So can external actors do any of those things in response to human rights violations? And which human rights violations? I don't think anybody's going to go to war to protect the right to join a trade union. So we're talking about something a little bit more serious than that. But then what are we talking about? Okay. All right. Then there is this sort of the more normative questions. If external actors read the West does that, is it just an imposition of Western views on other countries? Right? Some say human rights are just a Western invention. Others say, no, everybody signed up, NGOs in particular, was no, everyone signed up to this list of human rights, that they are universal. Right? But there is this view that then Western countries are just imposing their own views. And in fact, they might be imposing those views not because they really deeply care about whether or not citizens are being slaughtered somewhere, but because it's good for business if human rights are protected in a liberal democratic society. Then there is the perennial fear of the weak in international, the weak states, in that the responsibility to protect, which was declared by the United Nations in 2005, which implies that if a country, if a state, if a government can't protect its own citizens from grave violations of human rights, such as genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, then the international community should step in and protect those citizens. For some countries, that is just a recipe for another Iraq war, right? For intervention that is comes out of the sort of the minds of particular Western policymakers simply because they need an excuse to intervene in another country. So their reading is that responsibility to protect is just an excuse for old-fashioned neo-imperial intervention, right? It doesn't have anything to do with protecting citizens from genocide or crimes against humanity. This is paired with an equally critical view from inside the West, right, which goes, why should we waste a single taxpayer's dollar or pound or euro on somebody else, right? And why should we waste blood, the blood of our soldiers, on somebody else who lives in some hellhole in the middle of nowhere? Why should we care? You see that in the debate now about Afghanistan. You saw it in the debate about Iraq. So the sort of why should we care about citizens living in other jurisdictions? We should worry about our own, right, rather than other countries. All right. So those are the sorts of questions that are going to come up in IR 100 when you're talking about human rights. But you could also say protection of the environment, action against climate change under this, for example. Should we care about climate change? What can we do together? And so on. Should we force states to take action to counter climate change? Right now, the European Union, for example, has said that airlines should be included in a system which controls carbon emissions. Most other countries outside of the European Union have said that is abominable. There is no way our airlines are participating in any such scheme. Right? And you can't force our airlines to do that. Right? Well, the EU has said, yeah, well, we are. And the other states have said, well, we're going to take legal action against you. Nobody's going to go to war over airline emission. But that's classic. It's sovereignty versus measures to do something about a global problem, which is climate change. So those are the kinds of questions you will discuss in IR 100, inevitably in international political theory in your second year, in international organizations in your second year, in considerable depth in a course like sovereignty, rights, and justice in your third year, if you chose to take that particular course. All right? So that gives you a flavor of questions. Questions. It's all going to be questions. The whole thing's going to be questions, 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 to which you have to form some sort of an argument, find your place in sort of how you would respond to those kinds of questions. And then you would develop your arguments in the series of essays and presentations, and then ultimately exams. All right. I'm going to stop there, not there, and we have about 10 minutes for questions. Any questions from the audience?
Yeah, so you said that exams are going to be 100%, and you said that you get certain feedback on the course, etc. I just wondered if you've got a grade, you know, how you're doing during the year before. So it's not grading per se, it's just feedback.
Oh, no, you'll get, yeah, well, it will depend on the particular teacher, but... Most people are going to give you an idea of whether or not you're doing well or you're doing poorly, in addition to sort of feedback. Some people will actually give a numerical mark. I wouldn't say everyone does that, because some just don't like to do that. But they'll give you an idea. Is it a 2-1? Is it a first? So on and so forth. So you'll have that. Yes, you will have that kind of overall idea. But I wouldn't bank on that. You know, if you've been doing first class work all along, don't not study for the final exam. Study still. Because it doesn't always predict performance on the particular exam. But you will have some idea. Any other questions?
On average, how many hours of classes and lectures do you have a week?
Well, if you've got a lecture a week for four courses, that's 4 hours, plus 4 classes, that's another 4 hours. So that's plenty of time left to study. Any other?
How large is the IR faculty?
We're about 30 to 40. Yeah, 30 to 40.
If we take some of the language...
No, it's just listed under transcript. Yeah, yeah. No, they start at beginner's level. I mean, you could take beginning Russian, beginner Mandarin, and only they've so. I don't think they have other than beginner Mandarin, beginner Spanish, beginner French. Yeah, so far. This is not an up-to-date list. But that beginner implies, presumably, beginner. I mean, it doesn't imply an A level in the particular language. You could also go in at a higher level. I mean, I think that the Language Center runs sort of does diagnostic tests if you want to go in at a higher level. So you don't have to start at beginner level. You could start at a higher level if you have already studied that particular language. We have a list, so we have approved lists, and the idea is that you're doing an IR degree, you're not doing an accounting degree. I mean, if you want to do accounting, do accounting. So there is an approved list. I mean, if there was some course that doesn't happen to be on a list, and you can convince your academic advisor, your department tutor that you really have to take that course, then you can make that argument, and probably it would be accepted, I mean, depending on the particular course. But the idea is to try to make the degree coherent, right, so that you're taking courses. I mean, international relations covers a huge range of material from many different kinds of disciplines. So the list is relatively open in that sense, but it is preferable not to do, accountancy is, you know. Yeah. I mean, even then, it would have to be sort of international environmental policy rather than, say, you know, London's environment. I don't know if there is a course on that, but you need to make a case to why this fits into an IR degree. Any other I'll start there. Being international
relations, is there room for internships and also what type of organizations or businesses that do people call internships?
Well, all sorts of places. I mean, most people don't do internships during the year. I mean, they may try to work part-time during the year, but I don't think that they do that many internships. Not everyone. Most then try to do something during the summer. And those can be hard to get, but there is the careers office has a running, sort of a running list of available internships that you can apply for. But I mean, I've had students do a huge variety of things. I mean, I've got some of my second year undergraduate students, one of them is going to work in the Thai embassy in Myanmar, for example, over the summer. Another one, 1 year, I mean, I almost flipped. God, are you taking your flak jacket? Went to teach English in Sudan. So a huge variety of things that people choose to do during the summer. But the careers office, I mean, one of the things you'll be told to do when you arrive is to sign up with careers, because you can get constant updates of what's available. I mean, a variety of things. And some people go work in the city, you know. Big bucks, you know, in the city. So a huge variety of things.
Do you know what the course structure of the year abroad in Sciences Po would be like if you were to go there?
No, I don't. But I do know that I've got somebody that's there now, and I mean, that means you do 4 years, mm-hmm. Not three. So, but Sciences Po has certain rules, and then which I think is. I believe, if I can recall from memory, I think as long as you're meeting those rules, you're fine with us, because it's not counting towards your degree; it's just counting towards Sciences Po. You have to comply with Sciences Po's rules rather than our rules, because our rules are just those 3 years for that. Which is an excellent option, because then you get international experience and all the rest of it. But I think it's Sciences Po's rules for that particular year. I believe we do. I think we do. I think we do send out an email with that.
It seems like a lot of the course is kind of theory-based. So I assume that
you do have to, I mean, you have to get over, if you've got a sort of inbuilt panic button about theory, you're going to have to get over that, dismantle it, throw it away. I mean, on theory, I think international relations has theories. Right, and so the way to think of that is that there are different ways of answering those questions. Right, I mean, if you were to take those questions that I set out, if you could, from a realist perspective, there are certain ways that you would answer those questions. From a liberal perspective, there are certain ways that you would give an answer to all of those questions that would be coherent in themselves. From a constructivist, what's called constructivism in international relations, there are particular kinds of ways you would answer those questions. So theories can help you figure out what the various answers are to those particular questions. So you don't have to think of them as something scary. You can think of them as something helpful, as a way to navigate through the various kinds of arguments one could make about in answer to these types of questions. Right? I mean, realists tend to be quite sort of set on sovereignty, set on, you know, human rights are epiphenomenal. They don't really count in what counts as power. So, which already gives you a certain set of answers to those particular questions. So then you think about theories, and well, do I agree with the realists more, or do I agree with the liberals more, or do I agree with the constructivists more, and so on, right? So theories become a way of helping you to categorize particular arguments, right, and make coherent arguments about that. That's the way to think of them, rather than sort of, I mean, it's not, you know, physics. I mean, this is definitely not physics, but it's arguments and debates, right? So you would know, for example, based on your particular answers to these questions, confronting your friend who has different answers, you can kind of figure out which of you is more realist or more liberal or whatever, right? But you have, that's how theories can help you to do that, come up with coherent answers to these kinds of questions. And I think on the reading list, I think we do send it out, or it's under frequently asked questions on the website. But I'm pretty sure you're going to get an email from our departmental manager with kind of a list of that. Take the summer off. have a little vacation before you have to start. Now, don't go whole hog into it just quite yet. You'll have time to get on to that. But any other?
I heard LSE is kind of Eurocentric. What's your opinion?
Well, you are in Europe. I teach Europe. I object to people calling me Eurocentric. But there on that particular list of topics is quite a variety of topics, right? Which is going to happen in every single course. In fact, we only offer one course on Europe, right? Which I particularly don't agree with, but that's the way it is.
I also heard a lot of teachers from LSE are from the US. Why is that?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But I would back that up with empirical evidence, perhaps trying to find out whether that's really the case or not. So,
since IR is a pretty open-ended subject, I think there's probably lots of jobs that people go into, but looking at recent years, what would you say are the most common sectors that people go to work into?
Probably government of various types. I mean, around the world. Sometimes that's because the government has provided you with the scholarship, so you have no choice. So you've got to go give back to the government that paid for you. Other choices tend to be in the think tank sector or the private sector. But I have a feeling a very high percentage go on to further study, to an MSc degree. To some extent, NGOs, and to some extent, some people try to get themselves launched into the international organization route. But that's very, generally you have to go through government to get to that route. A huge variety. But I think probably a substantial chunk go on to an MSc. Any other questions? I have no idea. I don't know the course at all.
What do you teach?
I teach Europe's at the undergraduate level. I teach Europe's Institutional Order, which is a third year course. Yeah. So, did you?
For optional modules, are there any specifications
you need for the master's? Not in the IR department. Well, yes, there is one. It's for IR 304, which is Politics of International Economic or International Political Economy. What's it called? Politics of International Economic Relations. It's suggested that you should have some sort of an economics background, but it is not required. However, the law department is a little bit strange, a little bit kind of iffy on this, and there's the course International Protection of Human Rights. There is a prerequisite for this, which means in your second year, if you really want to take International Protection of Human Rights, you better make sure that your fourth paper in the second year it covers that particular prerequisite. But other course on this particular list, no. However, if on some course that you want for some outside option, you've got to check that out. You need to make sure that there isn't. Generally speaking, there isn't, but there are, like this human rights course, there are exceptions to that. Yeah. Any other?
In regards to the dissertation you did in the third year, if it's unsupervised, to what extent is it unsupervised?
It's supposed to be challenging. What you would do is you would have sessions on things such as how to write a dissertation, right? And then you will have a few small group sessions in which you will discuss your topic, your question, the particular question you are trying to answer in the dissertation. You could have discussions with your academic advisor or with another member of staff who has a particular interest in what you're writing on. but they can see no written work other than a small outline, and they can't give you any written feedback. So the idea is to ensure you're launched in the right direction. So do you have a proper kind of a question, a good outline? And then the rest is really up to you. So you could, you know, if you've got problems with things like finding sources or whatever, you go to your academic advisor and ask for advice. But the idea is really to get you to do an independent piece of work. So.
Follow-up question. It's marked at the end of the year, same for us, same on the exams.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? No? Okay. All right. Enjoy the rest of your visit in London. It's a pity we lost spring. I mean, you know, last week it was hot outside. Now I'm afraid it's not so hot. But enjoy the rest of your stay at the LSE, and we'll see you in October.
Sorry, I've got one question. How are you going to